Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
And we're back. Welcome to the Abolitionist Hour. I'm Carl G. It's starting to look a little bit like Halloween around here. In fact, the leaves haven't fallen off the trees yet. That's a bit of a sign that climate change is creeping on us at a faster pace. And so I got a maple tree out the window, so it kind of lets me know when fall is officially going to be here. But so out here where the temperature starts to drop below 60 degrees at night, it's when we really mobilize to prepare for winter camping for the homeless people in Kansas City. And we're expecting about 2,000 new campers this winter. And KC Tenants Union walked out on the mayor of Kansas City for his proposal last Friday, and that made the front page of the Kansas City Star. And hopefully we'll get somebody call in. Gaddafi said he might call in, but he was out in the rain for three nights, and that's the thing about doing homeless outreach and working with the homeless is it's not a nine to five job, which you might expect from a lot of people doing administrative work in organizing, but on the grassroots level, it never ends because you never know when somebody needs to go to the hospital. You don't know when there's some type of emergency, and so basically, KC Homeless Union is basically almost a taxi. It's almost an Uber. I wish they had an app. Or some way, some sort of switchboard. But right now, Gaddafi is working as the switchboard and the cab driver. And so sometimes it gets so cold that an automobile parked and idling is the only thing that, you know, four or five people got to keep warm in zero weather. So we got a lot of mechanics. Once a person can no longer put brakes and mufflers on cars because they're arthritic, we wind up getting them at the homeless camp. And so we're trying to get the police and the Parks and Rec to stop running people out of the camps once they're set up and established. And maybe we can get into that a little bit deeper some other time. But I'm expecting Kit O'Connell from Austin, Texas.
Yep.
Kit's pronouns
he's
are
on. He's on the air, Carl, and you might want to introduce him for your listeners, and he's listening in right now. He's on the air. Go ahead. Go ahead, Carl.
All right. Kim O'Connell's pronouns are they, them, he, them, he, him, is a movement journalist, radical troublemaker, and freelance writer from Austin, Texas. Kit is the former editor of Ministry of Hemp, and their writing has appeared in Fire Dog Lake, Truth Out, Yes Magazine, and the Texas Observer, among others. In 2020, Kit self-published a zine called Beyond the Concrete Milkshake, a short guide to dealing with hostile media and right-wing trolls at protests and gatherings. They're currently working on Soup for Our Families, an anti-fascist recipe zine, due out later this year. So you can find Kit online at kitoconnell.com and at Kit O'Connor on Twitter. So, Kit, are you there?
Yeah, hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for inviting me on, Carl. It's great to be on.
Yeah, we finally get to meet, and it's pretty impressive what you've done as a freelance journalist, at least since Occupy. I think that's when I started reading your work. And
oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, and so you know a lot of people, you know, we go to rallies and things, and you know we get observers, first time people that are checking it out, and you know it's interesting. Someone was asking me, you know, how can you tell the difference between a skinhead and then the Nazi skinheads on the other side of the line, and I always have to tell them, well, the right has always copied the left, and that the punk rock scene in Britain actually came out of the ska movement, from the Jamaican dock workers, and so that the attire came out of the punk movement there in the 80s, and then we saw it come across the Atlantic. And we had, you know, an anti-racist movement begin in the 1980s with the Sharps and the Rash, and so at what time did you pick up on, were you in high school, when did you start picking up that you wanted to be a journalist, and that you saw movements at appearing, say, back in the punk scene of the 90s?
Well, I was raised essentially as an activist. My mother took me to protests and actions in the anti-war and anti-capital punishment movement, starting essentially from birth. As far as when, and she also raised me to have an awareness of racism and white supremacy to a large extent. And as far as my own involvement with it, I have been involved in social justice activism since Occupy, but I wouldn't necessarily have started defining myself as specifically or actively anti-fascist until, you know, the last 5 years or so. I certainly spoke out against racism and anti-Semitism when it appeared at leftist gatherings previously to that. I think this is one of those cases where we so often see with a lot of activists and organizers and writers and journalists involved in anti-fascism. What I've noticed is they come to it through something else first. There's some people, of course, that come through it through the punk scene, and they directly encounter, you know, racism or skinhead, you know, racist skinheads or Nazis coming into their spaces. And I think there's another sort of similar path that I followed where I was involved in social justice activism and saw that the work I was doing was increasingly threatened by far-right trolls. Now, we saw that in Occupy to some extent, although I wouldn't have defined it that way. But looking back, I can see that, for example, some of the people that at that time supported Ron Paul were really some pretty far-right-leaning libertarian, you know, nationalist, fascist types that were trying to infiltrate Occupy. They were not particularly successful in Austin, where I'm located, they generally were chased out of the movement in Texas. But I know that that wasn't the case in all Occupy camps. There were some, I think, where the Ron Paul types kind of got a foothold. Of course, in 2011, it didn't seem as sinister as it all does now, even though I was aware, for example, that Ron Paul had in his newsletter published some pretty racist white supremacist stuff. The threat level of it, the immediacy of it, didn't feel like it does now, of course, for better or for worse.
Well, I highly recommend Beyond the Concrete Milkshake. And there's a bit of a joke about Concrete Milkshake, right? You're literally talking about the frozen custard milkshake called a concrete. Is that right?
It's a joke. There was an infamous incident where the right-wing provocateur, I'm not really going to call him a journalist, Andy Ngo, who works with the Post-Millennials, formerly with Quillette and other so-called publications, he infiltrated, pushed his way into an anti-fascist gathering in Portland, and he had a vegan milkshake thrown at his head, and he was roughed up a bit. This happened after he was sort of repeatedly provoking people, shoving his camera in their faces and generally trying to put people at risk. And eventually people retaliated this way. And while he was, from what anyone can tell, you know, basically just a little bit banged up, he pretended he had a brain damage, and he turned this into a fundraising grift. He was on all kinds of right-wing media, and even some center-left media voiced their support of him without investigating what he's really about. He raised something like six figures of worth of money on this grift, on this milkshake that he was hit with. And so that inspired me. I am not going to, you know, comment on whether or not people should have thrown a milkshake or roughed up Andy in that moment, but I wanted to create some tactics that they could use, not create them myself, but really gather from a variety of sources, my own knowledge and research and input from people who I work with or who follow me on Twitter, about other ways of dealing with people like Andy Ngo or just the other sort of the InfoWars reporters, the kinds of people that want to be them, the ones that sort of show up hostile, people who show up with a camera or a smartphone and start streaming and are putting people at risk. I think every group obviously needs to decide how they're going to handle media, but there's this sort of separate issue to handling media that needs to be decided. We also need to decide what are you going to do when these types of media trolls, as I called them in the zine, approach your movement and how you're going to handle that. Because you need to defend your movement from them, but the issue becomes, you know, if you do so in certain ways, you could actually create profit for them. You could give them this grift like Andy Ngo does by giving them footage of, oh, the violent Antifa hurt me with their big, bad concrete milkshake. Of course, there's no way to make a concrete milkshake. It's a myth that he spread after this incident. There's no way to mix the ingredients of the milkshake with concrete and have it harden. It's just not possible. He was hit with a normal milkshake and some people pushed him around. And frankly, he probably deserved that in the moment. I also wanted to offer people other options. For example, something that they've done in Portland, they call this the Press Protection Squad, which I think is very funny. They take hula hoops and they wrap them with bubble wrap, which essentially creates a soft barrier. You tape the bubble wrap on so it can't be just pushed off. So you have like a disc of bubble wrap, and they use that. They surround hostile media. You can also, of course, use umbrellas and similar barriers, and that's one of the techniques that I talked about in the zine based on talking with some of the people in Portland. They surround these people with these hula hoop devices that they create. So, of course, they have a small group of people that are assigned to do this ahead of time if they know that there's going to be a gathering that's under threat. And they surround them and just sort of, you know, guide them out of the area. The hula hoops block their cameras because of the bubble wrap, and it also creates a physical barrier that, you know, you can just kind of gently, without throwing concrete milkshakes, help them out of your area. And that's, you know, one of the things that I talked about in the zine.
You know, it's interesting that folks like Andy know they don't understand the difference between horizontal organizing and your regular top-down organizing, because recently Andy Ngo was accusing someone being as like the commander or the CENTCOM of Antifa. And we've heard this for years that, oh, we found the guy running, you know, Antifa, and, or, you know, if somebody, so they're always trying to pin someone as being the mastermind behind Antifa, but Antifa is more of a, would you say a hive how would you describe horizontal organizing as they're using it today on the left?
I like the idea of hive. It's funny. That's a fun word to use. It's interesting. We were talking about Occupy before, because that's another movement that was overall horizontal, and people were constantly trying to find the leader of it. We've certainly seen here in Austin that various people, myself included, have been accused of being the quote-unquote leader of Antifa at various times. And it's not, you know, it's a tendency, I suppose, or a belief. I think it is the belief that these ideas and philosophies associated with fascism need to be opposed, that they present a clear and present danger, that they present a real threat. We all kind of grew up seeing Nazis in Indiana Jones, and while it's very satisfying to watch him punch out the Nazis, it gave a lot of us the idea that Nazis were kind of this fictional threat that existed in the past. And, of course, people in the punk movement, as you point out, Carl, had a more recent encounter with them before the present day, and obviously a lot of marginalized groups have dealt with them as a clear and present danger throughout the history of the United States. But I think, anyway, for a lot of us, we had to have some sort of wake-up call to kind of push us into getting involved in this type of activism.
Yes, indeed.
As far as horizontalism goes, I decided to wrap up your question. You know, I think it's always important to remember that a movement that has a leader can be taken out. It's also just unrealistic to deal with all the different issues that we are facing in an organized movement. I think, you know, while it's great for me to talk with you about what you're dealing with in, you know, Kansas City, about what I'm dealing with in Austin, we are also facing different situations, and it wouldn't make sense to have a hierarchy or an organization. I always like when people talk about, this is definitely not my idea, instead of talking about a leaderless movement, sometimes we talk about a leaderful movement, and the idea that people are empowered to do what they feel like needs to be done. If you see Nazi stickers around town, take the initiative, get some friends, take them down, put up some stickers of your own. You don't need anybody's orders or instructions to do that. There's certainly people that will help you and offer you guidance. But anti-fascism is something that anybody can be involved with. All you have to do is see a problem and take action.
Indeed. And we're seeing some parallels between politics in Missouri and politics in Texas. And we heard a lot of support at the Women's March 3 weeks ago for the abolitionists of right-wing obligations, or so they feel, to control a woman's health, reproductive health. And up here we had a black trans woman speak and lead the march, and this was a breakthrough, because we needed more trans people in the forefront and speaking as leaders, and so we're making some ground, and down there where you're at, it's a little bit different. I think you probably got more people moving in to retire and things like that. Where here I saw on a list, I think we sold 450 houses that were worth over $1 million in over the summer. And so what type of gentrification and sweeping of the camps do you have going on in Austin right now?
So we have a major housing crisis here. Our rental prices are just flying through the roof across the city. People are being forced out of the city. The city council tried to take a progressive step, and what they did was repeal the camping ban here. So it allowed people to camp, sit down, lie down, and basically live their lives. The city council has been maybe not fast enough for everyone's taste, but they have been working to buy old, abandoned, or closed down motels and convert them to housing for people who don't have housing. But unfortunately, a very rich and moneyed and right-wing group called Save Austin Now came in and put a ballot initiative on our last election, which reinstated the camping ban for most of the city. And as a result, there have been just devastating sweeps of our neighbors who don't have homes. A lot of their tents and possessions have been destroyed. And now what we're dealing with is the same group, Save Austin Now, this very wealthy group, has another ballot initiative that's on our election. Early voting actually starts next week for this. And this is called Proposition A. And what Proposition A would do in Austin is it would peg police funding to population. And that would require an immediate investment of hundreds of millions of dollars into our already bloated police budget. And inevitably, just because of how capitalism and modern politics works, I believe, and lots of people believe, that's going to mean cuts to other city services. Regardless of whether that's true, it's obviously going to mean a massive increase to the police, who already have much too much funding. And in general, the people of Austin itself, they came out in the thousands, you know, over the summer to protest in the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer. But these moneyed interests, very wealthy groups, many of them that live in the very wealthy and extremely gentrified parts of town, are investing heavily to try to force these propositions through. They succeeded in reinstating the camping ban. It's already devastated a lot of people's lives. And unfortunately, we'll see what happens with this Proposition A. We all are kind of holding our breath to see what happens with that, because it would make it extremely hard to fund important services and very hard to move any funding out of police. That's already going to be challenging because our state government actually passed a law basically requiring you to maintain the same police budget. So it's already going to be challenging for us to cut the budget, but this bill, this proposition, if it passes in this election that starts next week with early voting, would increase the police budget immediately by millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, and just it's an appalling thing to consider that we may be faced with here in Austin. And I think if it passes here, we're going to see this as model legislation that pops up in all kinds of other places.
Indeed. Missouri and Texas are the only two states that continued to execute prisoners during the COVID-19 outbreak of the last 18 months. And we see our mayor, or not mayor, he's a governor. He come out of law enforcement. And so we're seeing a lot of that. Prosecutors, Department of Corrections administrators jumping over into state politics. And are you seeing anything like that in Austin? Are they coming out of San Antonio, or what part of the state has the most right-wing candidates this year?
I mean, as far as what part of the state, you know, they've incredibly gentrified, incredibly gerrymandered the state, so that our districts are just bizarrely shaped, and they're in the process of doing it again right now, and just slicing up any districts that are starting to, you know, have a left-leaning bent. So unfortunately, they sort of come from all over, but that doesn't mean, of course, because of the gerrymandering, that doesn't mean that our whole state is conservative by far. There's a lot of people on in our state that have more social justice and human rights oriented views. Unfortunately, their voices get really drowned out. We have, you know, our governor Greg Abbott and Lieutenant, you know, Governor Dan Patrick, and just their people that are part of this sort of dynasty of corrupt conservative Republican politicians that now we've seen in the state. And, you know, Abbott is clearly trying to push to be someone who's going to take a national office. And I think it's just in general, it's really important for people to watch what's happening in Texas. I think what happens here often spreads to other places. I think there's a tendency to dismiss places like where we live, you and I, as just being hopelessly conservative by people that live in, you know, so-called liberal places. But the reality is that, you know, everything that's happening here is going to come to where everyone lives. It's nowhere that's really unique right now.
Indeed. We've got a lot of fighters for social justice in Kansas City and in Austin, Texas. And we've been at it a while. And we've got people doing inspiring work. And it really gives us hope to, you know, just even for the next few years, because it's the most critical, possibly the most critical time of our civilization is we're here upon it with climate change and sea level rising and of course we get a lot more rain up here than you do down there, but you had a freeze last winter that was just uncommon for that area. Is that right? Can you talk about the...
It was extremely uncommon for this area. Yeah, we had a shocking freeze over the winter, early this year. And it just it killed many people, caused a lot of devastation. People were without... Some apartment complexes were without reliable water for weeks or even... I think in some cases a couple months after the freeze. A lot of it comes from the fact that our power grid is separate from the rest of the power grid in the country and it's become extremely unreliable, and they've refused to invest in it. The Texas state government essentially meets for a few months every 2 years. For about 6 months out of every 2 years, our state government meets and passes bills. And that's in the process of happening right now. The session would have ended earlier this year, but they keep extending it because of the fighting that's happening over the various bills they're trying to pass. Now, of course, this would be the perfect opportunity to fix that power grid, to pass robust bills improving the infrastructure here. But instead, they've prioritized banning abortion and oppressing trans and non-binary and intersex kids. And I think it's all part of an overall puritanical agenda that we're seeing the GOP push through. One of the lawyers responsible for banning abortion has publicly stated he thinks that we should try to make gay sex illegal again. And we also recently had a reporter basically get Abbott to say that he would be willing to try to ban the morning after pill and birth control pills, as well as a sort of follow-up to the current situation with abortion. So instead of fixing our power grid, which is the thing that we all need to keep us safe, instead they have these disgusting anti-human agenda. And I think it's also, you know, the freeze was shocking and horrible, and we're going to see more unusual weather events because of climate change. But we actually had a really mild summer this year. We had very few hot days, and even despite that, we had a couple of times where they were worried that the power grid was going to go down. And that's really worrying because climate experts here in Texas are saying that we'll have a month of days over 100 degrees in our future. Sometime in the next 10 to 15 years, it will become normal for there to be a month or more of 100-plus degree days. And our power grid as it stands now cannot handle that. And you talked about, you know, who's moving here. we still have an ongoing tech boom. Tesla just announced that they're moving to Austin. We've had a bunch of other tech companies who are moving or have already or just moved to Austin. So some areas that were traditionally where some of the more lower income people got pushed now are becoming the sites of new tech campuses. And so then those people are getting pushed even further out, and it's becoming a real crisis.
Yeah, that's frightening to think about, and that's already upon us. That's not 10 years from now. You know, this isn't what the zero population growth people it's not too far from what the zero population growth people were predicting 40 years ago. And somehow I feel it's Ronald Reagan who told Jimmy Carter, there you go again, when Carter was saying we needed to tighten our belts and we can make it harder for us in the future or work towards this now. And of course that was passed up, and we started seeing trickle down economics. Now you got a Senator Ted Cruz, and he actually got on a plane and went to Cancun during the freeze. Is that correct?
Yep, he was dragged pretty heavily for it, and he ended up having to come back. And one of the really appalling parts is he tried to basically blame his family for it and said that they needed a break and he'd done it for them. And so he basically threw his wife and kids under the bus. And, of course, lots of people needed a break. They were out of power. People were dying in their homes while he was on his way to Cancun. They were literally dying in their homes from lack of power and the cold and lack of water during this freeze, as he was on his way to a paradise, because he's one of our rich leaders that is completely out of touch with what actual Texans want.
And that was interesting how citizen media kicked in on that story, and someone actually caught him at the airport leaving. Is that right?
Yeah,
that was an interesting take. That was something that we would have never seen had not someone been there, and had it not been for Twitter. I know you have a lot of interesting journalists that you follow on Twitter, and some of them were on January 6th in D.C. And so you did an article. What was it? After January 6th, we're all anti-fascist now. Is that right?
Yeah. I just sort of wanted to, I think, highlight the importance of that event. And as we've seen in the months since then, the right wing has simultaneously sort of mythologized what happened there by trying to make a hero out of Ashley Babbitt. At the same time, they've downplayed what happened there. And it's just, just some people looking around the building. Why are we so worried about it? And while I certainly think we need to replace the system that we have now, we can't let it be replaced by these clowns. That's incredibly dangerous. There's genocidal fascists that are trying to take power in our country. There's no other or kinder way of putting it, and we need to stop them by any means necessary. And that makes us all essentially anti-fascist. We all should have been taking that side a long time ago, but it's that time now that we all have to take a side. And I think we're seeing just essentially at every level they're pushing, right? The actions that we're seeing with anti-vaxxers and just general white supremacists of various stripes taking action at school board meetings is really terrifying. I don't know if you saw, there was that story that just went viral that in Southlake, Texas, the superintendent instructed teachers that if they had a book about the Holocaust, they also had to have a book about an opposing viewpoint. And so an opposing viewpoint to the Holocaust, I guess, being pro-Nazi. And that's the state of things in Texas right now. And again, some of that goes back to the state legislature. They passed this bill banning, you know, so-called critical race theory, which of course is so vaguely defined when they use that term. It does have a specific meaning, but when they use the term, it's the same kind of boogeyman as when they use the word Antifa, which, you know, brings me back to that article, essentially, that, you know, I think everybody should choose to align themselves with anti-fascism. However, the right wing is going to associate anyone to the left of Glenn Greenwald with anti-fascism right now. Anyone who's even remotely left, they're going to decide is Antifa and threaten them. We saw, of course, you know, one example when there were fires in the Pacific Northwest, people started setting up roadblocks to prevent mutual aid groups and volunteers and even just photojournalists from entering the area because they'd heard through, you know, fascist media, through right-wing media, that, quote-unquote, Antifa were setting fires. There was also an incident where non-white family, I don't remember all of their details of their background, but they were a non-white family that were camping, and they were actually basically held hostage by a group of locals who decided that they were Antifa invading their community. These weren't even activists. These were just a family on vacation, and they ended up being rescued by some local kids who basically used a chainsaw to cut away a tree that had been used to block their escape. So, you know, in that instance, those local kids who saw a problem picked up a chainsaw and cut this tree out of the way so a family could escape. They were Antifa. And I guess that was sort of, you know, they're going to call us all Antifa, so we might as well all be Antifa in this moment because it's just such a critical battle. You know, someone asked me recently, what's the most important struggle? Is it anti-fascism? Is it, you know, queer rights? Is it climate change? What is it? And I just don't think we can separate those out. That was one of the things that I think a lot of us saw through Occupy, that this movement that started about a specific thing, maybe, you know, inequality and the big banks and Wall Street growing out of control and the fact that a few people were holding all the wealth, you know, quickly became about all these other related issues. I was involved in Occupy Austin with the LGBTQ plus, you know, working group, the OccuQueers that formed here, and we were one of the most active groups because it was very easy to see the intersection between, you know, oppression of marginalized groups and Wall Street. And I think we can continue to see that today when corporations are funding politicians like Ted Cruz and Greg Abbott who are attacking our rights every day.
Yeah, you know, I think about when I was in high school and we had a mayor that it was a small town, but she was really good at just calling out for mean behavior and you know, keeping the place safe, the community safe. And once she retired, we got more of an authoritarian figure as mayor in that town, and that's really when violence towards LGBT began to show up, and to the point that, you know, I have nothing, no good memories of that place. It just washed anything good about the area when I realized my LGBT friends were being attacked and sometimes killed down there. And it's more common than people think. You know, it's the media chooses not to report on it, and you don't necessarily see a lot in newsprint. I mean, Kansas City, you know, has probably lost 90% of their reporters from their heyday, and if it's not for people on the ground making notes and posting on bulletin boards and things like that, we won't find out. You know, to the extent that fascism has infiltrated our culture, and the rural areas need our help too, and you know, this zine that you're working on right now, Soup for Our Families, an anti-racist recipe zine. That's due out later this year. I sent you a gazpacho recipe. I don't know if that made the zine or not.
I want to include your gazpacho recipe.
So tell me about this, because I kind of have an idea about a couple zines that I put out, you know, where I basically make a list. Yours seems to be a little more involved, but I try to make the pantry as affordable as possible, and simple recipes and things like that. So what is your approach to your zine?
So for mine, the unifying theme of my zine is just recipes collected from people who identify as anti-fascist or part of the anti-racist movement. I just feel like food is one of the most primal and important things, and it's something that brings people together, not just in the sense of all of us gathering for a meal, but it also inspires people to action in a way that a lot of other issues don't necessarily. When I got involved in Occupy Austin, I had taken a bit of a break from activism. I said, as I mentioned before, that I was raised as an activist. I'd been involved in various projects through my 20s and stuff, but I'd sort of fallen out. And I heard about Occupy. I knew it was happening here. I was very excited about it. But what inspired me to jump in with both feet and really get involved for the remainder of the movement, which lasted for quite a while here, for almost 2 years there were people gathering under that name here. What really inspired me was a night about, it was around Halloween of 2011, and the city had decided that it was against, that they were going to arrest anyone that was sharing food after, I believe it was 10 p.m. And people decided, no, we want to continue to share food. There was an active encampment. There were people coming in that were hungry at all different times. As you mentioned, this kind of work does not keep 9 to 5 hours. And so people continued to serve food. And the police came in to make arrests. And some other people sat down and said, no, we're not going to let you. And all in all, there were 30 arrests that night. And I heard about this happening, and I was just infuriated. Like, how can you do that? How can you stop people from feeding each other? And that made me really just angry, and that really inspired me to get involved 10 years ago, almost to today, and about a couple weeks from now, 10 years, and for me. And that's what inspired me to get involved in the movement. I ended up being basically helping to organize the social media team for Occupy Austin. But for me, it all started with food. And I feel like food is just like this important issue. I also feel like in the zine, you know, I am including simple recipes and complex recipes and recipes from people who's, a lot of people end up contributing their kind of family recipes. And I love that because it shows how diverse this idea of anti-fascism is, that people from all backgrounds and walks of life get involved in it. I think there's this idea that anti-fascism is only a certain type of person, maybe Portlanders, the sort of people you see on Portlandia. But the reality is that there's all kinds of people who are involved in anti-fascism. Your neighbors are involved in anti-fascism, speaking to your listeners. Someone near you is, even if you aren't yourself. And so I have, you know, Jewish cooking. I have Swedish cooking. I have Southern cooking. I have tacos that are designed to feed a gathering that is, you know, here called Street Forum, which is a gathering for people without homes and their supporters. So it's a recipe designed to make a huge mess of food for a bunch of people. I also have some, you know, complicated salmon bakes that people sent in. I just wanted to sort of show how we're all kinds of people. We all share food. We all hate Nazis. And I guess my hope is that as Community transmission rates continue to drop and we start to gather again, you know, outdoors and safe places and vaccinated groups and all that, that we start to share food again and we use that as a basis to build more action and closer networks and closer connections between groups and between organizations, because I think we really need to be building a really unified front right now. And for me anyway, you know, food is kind of just like the bedrock of all of that.
Indeed, because a lot of these skill shares and confluences and meetings, it's not uncommon for there'd be 36 hours of meetings over a 3 or 4 day period. And if you got good food, people are going to stick around. And so I can't say enough about what you've been doing there, especially on the kitchen end. And so what is your bare bones cooking arrangement? If you were going to show up and cook for 40 people, what would you have to have? Right, this is kind of a question I'm just throwing in. But do you prefer gas? Do you prefer electric? Do you prefer electric griddles, electric fry pans? What is your favorite thing?
When I cook for big groups of people, I have often hit festivals before sometimes where I've ended up feeding that many people, and I love really simple, like pasta salads are a great, really simple option. I feel like that's a great option for serving a whole bunch of people. When I've been cooking for people, in 40 people showing up and I'm helping to cook for them, I always love a Coleman, propane or butane cook stove. And I feel like, you can't go wrong, with some pasta, with some tacos, if you can get a mess of tortillas and shredded cheese. Once you got that, you've got this, you just got to throw together some kind of filling, and that can be cheap, potatoes and beans, and bam, you've got a breakfast tacos, and people are going to gobble those up. Throw some salsa in there, and you're good to go.
Oh yeah, I tell you the tofu scramble is I have fond memories.
Yeah.
They actually prepare the night before and soak all their vegetables in water so they're nice and nice and plump and everything and they do the American fries, the diced potatoes. And the tofu scramble and a lot of people are introduced to tofu by the tofu scramble. Have you had luck with tofu over the years, or what is your opinion of tofu?
I like tofu a lot. I'm a big fan. The tofu scramble, you can't forget the nutritional yeast, right? That's the key ingredient to the tofu scramble, in my opinion. I love tofu. One of the things we eat almost every sort of meal-type holiday here, the winter holidays, I often make a tofu pot pie, which is, real simple. Just stir-fry some diced tofu, put it in a pie crust with some vegetables, potato chunks, broccoli, corn, whatever vegetables you want to throw in there. You could do a pie topping, or we often do a mashed potato topping. Put some vegan gravy in there. You can find some easy recipes online for the real delicious vegan gravy. You put that in there before you put the top on. It's so good. That is just one of my favorite things to serve at Thanksgiving. As far as other tofu dishes, you can do a lot with it. I love baked tofu is a real simple one, and you can make a whole lot of baked tofu real easy. And then people can do a lot of stuff with it. You could serve it on sandwiches, or you could throw it in salads. People could just eat it by themselves. It's real sort of soft. It takes on, if you've never had baked tofu, it takes on like kind of a, almost like a cheesy, softer texture that's a little bit different, a little firmer. It's really delicious. So that's a good option too.
I saw tofu at Costco, and I think it was a 4-pound box, but it was already pressed. That was one of the obstacles I always had with tofu is you had to press it. You had to like set it on a plate with a dish towel and then another plate on top of it, and then like a can of corn to press it overnight to get it firm. And then at least Costco figured out that people like firm tofu, and so that was good to see. I like easy access to tofu because that determines how much I actually use it.
I understand.
Yeah,
I also been cooking with tempeh a lot recently because I feel like that's sometimes a little bit easier. Like you don't have to press it. The tempeh is like a kind of a cake made out of soybeans that have been fermented together. So it's a different texture from tofu, and I like it because it's when it's prepared. I guess it's really easy to make yourself. I haven't tried that yet. But the store-bought stuff is very simple. You don't need to press it. You just slice it up and stir-fry it. I like all these kinds of options, beans, soybeans, tofu. For me, I prefer them to some of the newer, like, impossible meat and stuff. I'm not a big fan of those personally. I like tofu a little bit better, beans, cheese. I'm not vegan, so I eat eggs. Personally, like protein sources for myself.
And so you're also a gardener, is that right?
I used to be. I'm not currently one. I do have some experience doing that, and I love doing it. Right now, I just don't have the space. My spouse keeps a lot of succulents, cactuses and whatnot, in our area and some lovely greenery. But right now we don't really have food plants in my house, but I do love to grow it. I used to have a lot of tomatoes, and I would harvest here in Austin. You can find wild onions growing just pretty much all over the place in this area. Anywhere that it's kind of moist and marshy, you get wild onions, and they are delicious. The onions themselves are very small, so they can be a little hard to use, but the shoots are delicious, and one of the things I love to do is you can, like, chop up the shoots and use them instead of basil for, like, a spicy pesto. It is delicious.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And now, do you have a Food Not Bombs that's active in Austin?
I believe there is, yes. I do not have a personal connection with them, but I believe there is one, and I know that there's one in Houston. And one of the reasons I know that is that they in Houston have occasionally bumped heads with the city because the city in Houston tried to ban feeding people in public without a permit, which, of course, Food Not Bombs is not going to get a permit. Now, so far, the city has mostly not gone after Food Not Bombs. I can't say they've left them alone, but they haven't shut them down. But they definitely have been under threat there. And that's the kind of thing that obviously we're seeing in a lot of places where they're trying to ban feeding people, which is absolutely ridiculous. It makes my head explode. It blows my mind to think about the things, it's basic human activities that we've made illegal, feeding people, sitting down, lying down, sleeping, putting a tent up. Like, these are things that literally, like, gorillas create hammocks and sleep in them. So our ancestors do this, and we've made it illegal. It's so out of whack with just anything that seems right to me. And I see those as being very connected.
And indeed. Our economy is slowing down as a result of COVID, but I feel the general public is beginning to sense that slowing down is not a bad thing, and I think we've seen about 5 million people walk off the job in recent weeks, and talks of general strikes and things like that. I think we have a Kellogg's plant that's been in the news. Is there any strikes going on down in Austin?
I'm not aware of any specifically here. I certainly am keeping an eye out. It's very exciting to see all the strikes popping up all over the place. I love to see that. And I think as you point out, we've essentially are seeing a sort of unspoken strike happening, and that's the reason that so many terrible underpaying or poor or jobs that mistreat their workers are having such a hard time filling their positions. And so I think we are seeing kind of this quiet strike at this point that's pretty widespread. I'm someone who has disabilities. I have fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain condition. And a lot of disabled people, while many of us, of course, were vulnerable to COVID-19, we also saw during the pandemic that, not only, like you said, did life slow down in certain ways, but we also saw that certain things were opened up, like Zoom meetings for education and workshops and planning and organizing were able to move online. And I think it's really important, and work, of course, itself, from home, all of that, I think it's really important that we maintain and expand that rather than just push right now, like, okay, everybody back into office and pretend that we didn't have all these accommodations over the last 18 months to 2 years, pretend that none of that happened. Everything has to go back to how it was. And like you said, I think we're seeing a lot of people say, no, that's not possible. There's no way to go back to that. And I'm really glad to see that people are standing up for themselves in that way. I think it's so important.
Yes, it's inspiring. Now, you worked on a lot of hemp research, and was it the Ministry of Hemp? Was it a magazine, an online magazine, or?
That's right. Essentially, it was an online magazine. It's moved on to other ownership since the team that I was working on it with. But a lot of my writing is still out there. You can find a lot on my website that I moved over there. And we were essentially a news and information site about hemp and, of course, CBD, since that's one of the most prominent products made from hemp right now. We were trying to not only cover scientific facts about hemp, to sort of separate some of the mythology and the hype around CBD, we also wanted to promote other forms of hemp, because while, I take some CBD every day, I think it's valuable for people who have like chronic pain like I do. There's a lot of other uses for hemp, and we'd like to see those spread much more than they are currently.
Excuse me, we're running out of time. By the way, listeners, it's Kit O'Connell, KITOCONNELL.com. And Kit, I noticed you had a recent post on at KitOConnell.com about Delta 8. I was very interested in it. Great website, by the way. Go there, listeners. We have got to go.
Thank you. Sorry to
do that to you. Yeah, thank you. Here we go. And you, and by the way, you could be a supporter of Kit O'Connell for as little as a dollar a month. So consider helping out KitOConnell.com.
Thanks so much. I'd love to come back. I had a great time talking.
All right, thanks, Kit.
Thank you.
I traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door. And the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, got no work for you no more. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door.
and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the demon sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the miner sweated for. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land. I've prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble with a guard at every door, and we would share those vaults of silver that we have sweated for.